26th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chan.
Welcome to the podcast that's as hard to predict as a Cyan Agile delivery.
Yeah, his teaser has been getting everyone a little bit excited over the last couple of weeks, hasn't it?
Yeah, he's certainly been the highlight for me of, well, 2012 so far, actually. I mean, my cricketing highlight, I'd say. Perhaps not the highlight
what
of my
your,
entire
your,
world.
Actually, I was about to ask what your personal highlights
no,
are, but we've been getting
not?
Off the point.
Actually, why not? Cyan Agile is actually my just general highlight of 2012 so far, both
personal
and
cricketing.
Well, and
actually, one of the distinctive things about him is that as a personality, he has come across really, really well.
Right, and he's fun. He's in this era of kind of excessive professionalism. He plays with fun, plays with a smile and enthusiasm. And there's a suggestion that as someone who had to wait a long time for a career in international cricket, he's now determined to enjoy himself, determined to have fun. I really liked the way he dominated the pre-match build-up to this Pakistan-England series. He kind of played it almost like a boxer before a fight, trying to kind of hype it with all his talk about the Tisra. And frankly, it maybe worked. Something certainly got into the heads of the England batsmen. I also kind of like the fact that he relies on guile. I've not really seen him take many wickets through sheer turn. He has this very sort of distinctive quick wrist action that makes it very, very hard to read.
It's hard to read, and it's difficult to know, actually, at the moment, how far it's him being good bowler and the English batsman being crap, or how far it is that it's his bowling that puts enough doubt in the batsman's mind and therefore induces him
exactly.
To take that
chance. England played him terribly in the first test. They played him slightly better
some of the kind of good length balls stick your front pad a long way down and heave across the line with horrible. I mean, it was.
But I think a lot of that doubt and indecision he must take the credit for. I mean, let's not forget, you know, this is a class England batting lineup. There are players who've consistently scored against the best bowlers in the world, and Ajmal has created that doubt. So whereas I've been getting excited about the bowler, you've kind of been getting excited about things at the other end of the pitch.
Yeah, I have. And Ajmal has been quite a big part of it, actually. I've been quite enjoying the fact that the batting collapse seems to have returned to world cricket. We were worried for a long time about the fact that the bat was coming to dominate the ball. I mean, the ICC kept on going on about how it was having to, you know, reduce the size of bats and all of this kind of thing in order to try and equalise the battle between the bat and the ball. And we've seen in all of the test series going on at the moment, actually, apart from New Zealand and Zimbabwe, but we can leave that to one
side. I'm sure Zimbabwe will take care of that.
Yeah, quite. certainly with the Sri Lankans in South Africa, we've seen some pretty spectacular collapses. I'm not a fan of collapses per se, and collapses where you have Sri Lanka being all out for 42 or whatever it was.
It is
kind of fun in a sadistic way. But what I am a fan of is the way that in both the, well, less so in the Australia-India series, but particularly in the England-Pakistan or Pakistan-England series, the way that there have been sort of mini collapses all the way through that have made things really, really interesting. And we saw this yesterday with when Cook and Trott were obviously racing away, and then suddenly
did Cook and Trott ever race?
Were
accumulating, plodding.
And then there was a little collapse, and it just changes the complexion of the game.
There's
really
something
often.
Wonderfully retro now about an England batting collapse. It instantly makes me think of England when I first started watching cricket, sort of in the 90s. It's sort of a compliment to this current side that I just don't associate this current lineup with collapsing.
Now, one thing that we might associate batting collapses with, if we're not careful before long, is this Indian lineup.
This series has, to say, this series has been my letdown. It was my letdown last podcast. It's still my letdown. It's just been, I honestly think it's just been such a disappointment. I think this series had the potential to be fantastic. Full credit to Australia. It's so impressive to see how they've turned themselves around, I think, in a year. The purpose in the side, and frankly just the talent in the side, they look a really good outfit.
Michael Clarke is a new man. Definitely.
Michael Clarke is genuinely an entirely different human being to that played 12 months ago. But the big story here is India, and I actually think the word pathetic isn't too strong to describe their mental, like, their just disinterest in the contest. They have the ability. I cannot be persuaded that this India team doesn't have. This India team clearly could make this a contest.
Yeah.
And they just simply do not seem to have the mental wherewithal as a side to make that happen. I found that really
particularly often, because very often when you have as heavy defeats as there were in the first test for a start, that kind of always galvanises a side, and that doesn't seem to have happened at all.
Where's the pride? I mean, I'm trying to go, but you feel like there are players there like Sehwag, Dhoni, Tendulkar, Laxman. These are players who've achieved it all at the highest level. They should not be tolerating this. No. Rant over.
Yeah, rant over. Well, I've got a bit of a well, not a rant necessarily.
Go on, match my rant. Be angrier.
But well, it doesn't make me angry. It makes me sad. It's the way that the spot fixing we've all known has been going on for a while. But we've all associated it with most directly actually with Pakistan, and a lot of the analysis that has gone around it has centred around the individual circumstances that have given rise to spot fixing in Pakistan. And so the conviction of Mervyn Westfield of Essex is rather sort of galling, actually. The thought that that spot fixing isn't refined to the big money or to the sort of to the international stage.
It has moved the debate on, but at the same time, we're still in this rather awkward position where we have no idea of the extent of the disease as such. There are still the sort of pessimists who really feel like this might be completely endemic in Canterbury, and we don't know. And there are still those who are arguing quite strongly that these are isolated things. Yep. And frankly, we just don't know.
No, we don't, but it does at least, as you say, it moves the debate from being individual circumstances of individual cricketers in an individual setup in Pakistan mainly, to a question, a kind of soul searching, which is across the game completely. And it's actually quite the fact that it's happened to a player of an English county, which is supposed to be sort of the epitome of cricket as it should
sort
be played, cricket,
county, yeah.
Cricket for cricket's sake, I think is actually really significant.
From the archives, and as Pakistan and England battle it out in Abu Dhabi, Toby has chosen this episode to give us a little bit of an insight into the tale of cricket in the United Arab Emirates.
Yeah, it's interesting as an England fan, England playing in a country about which I have absolutely no idea, sort of as a country.
Well, we were having issues beforehand, weren't we, distinguishing the difference between Abu Dhabi and Dubai?
I thought we weren't supposed to admit that on air.
Well, but I think that's an honest admission of our issues regarding that particular region.
It is, exactly. But certainly where I definitely have issues is on the long and distinguished history of cricket in the United Emirates. And in fact, it goes back longer than I had ever imagined. And typically it goes back to the 19th century, and typically it goes back to the British introducing games, when they also introduced all kinds of things to all kinds of countries all over the world. So in 1892, some British soldiers were stationed in the United Arab Emirates to look after the sheikdoms. And like various other Middle Eastern countries to which the British had introduced cricket, Afghanistan is a good example, Israel as well, the game began to decline after the British occupation left, simply because it was always sort of the preserve of the colonialists, if you like, and the local population never really took hold of it. But unlike Afghanistan and Israel, there wasn't any real local interest in the slightest. In Afghanistan, there was a bit of missing, a bit of the fruits of it now.
And there's been a real revival now.
There's been a real revival, exactly. And actually, this means that what has happened in the United Arab Emirates to get them to the status now in which they're actually hosting a test has been really remarkable, because usually it's England taking cricket elsewhere and influencing, but there it's been Pakistan exporting its game and taking it to another country. And so when, in the 1980s, when a significant number of immigrants went from Pakistan to the UAE, they started setting up cricket teams and leagues. And it wasn't just the case of the Pakistanis playing, the locals took hold of it as well. And it's now actually the case that the United Arab Emirates are considered to be the best non-test playing Asian country, which I didn't actually No, at all.
They have, because they have made World Cup appearances and sort of ICC trophy appearances. But it's interesting to the extent that you have the test match being played there. But as you said, it's not driven by any sort of national interest, not a sort of the people of the region haven't sort of bought into it or got behind it.
No, not at all. I mean, we've seen basically completely empty stadia throughout, well, certainly for the first test and a half, until today, I think, when on Friday, the equivalent,
well, this is
the weekend equivalent, it suddenly becomes full.
And suddenly,
full up,
all these Pakistani, and apparently, as I said, I've had the chance to see very little of today, but apparently it was very raucous and really sort of good sport. And it's fascinating how you've effectively got a sort of cricket colonialism. I mean, this has become, the sort of Abu Dhabi and Dubai grounds have become, you know, extend grounds for the Pakistanis.
Exactly, it's exactly the kind of thing that England was doing 60 years ago and more. But what is interesting actually is that I mean, you say that it's not being taken on by the local population, but actually the amount of money that's being put into cricket in the United Arab Emirates is huge. And the first test was played at the Dubai Sports City Cricket Stadium, which is a name that rolls off the tongue. And that's where the Pakistan and South Africa played a series in 2009. And the whole thing, I mean, it calls itself Sports City, and the clue's in the name, really. But they have a huge cricket stadium, which is the one that the test was played in. But then they have another stadium, which is specifically for cricket, that seats about 25,000. And so there's a huge amount of money going in here. And you wonder how much, when Pakistan are able, and I hope it's as soon as possible, to be playing their home test in Pakistan again, how far the game is going to, you know, whether it is just an artificial imposition of a game that no one cares
about. This is the fascinating question that I think everyone has to ask, because ultimately a lot of people regard it as really sad that Pakistan are having to play there. You know, people miss the fact that they're not in Karachi, they're not in Lahore, which in themselves are venues of incredible sort of cricketing history and venues of incredible atmosphere as well. And you do wonder, it would be a fascinating thing when Pakistan pull out, when Pakistan have the opportunity to play in the country, will they pull out entirely of cricket in the United Arab Emirates? Will they abandon this? It's really interesting. Or will they start something which would be really quite dynamic if you think about it? Will this become a regular thing, this idea that they will continue to play cricket abroad?
What I think is quite interesting is that actually Pakistan have achieved here more than the ICC, International Cricket Development Board, or whatever on earth it's called,
it should be called,
has ever achieved. They have been able to stage cricket in a non-test playing nation.
The power of cricket-loving migrants to spread the game is far greater than the power of an ICC board. I mean, I think this is the key point. And there's an interesting little case study in New York of like New York League cricket, which has become a really big thing within the city, but is entirely immigrant-driven. But I think the interesting question here is Dubai in itself now has huge financial problems. Abu Dhabi is much more stable. Yep. But there's been this incredible boldness about that region. I mean, you talked about the willingness to spend money. I mean, they've spent money on everything. And it's an interesting model of cricketing expansion, because they ignored the fact there wasn't the local
that no one wanted
and
to be there. It's something that's top down rather than it's not people taking the game and therefore the game growing. It's
right.
People coming and it's sort of imposing the
ignore
game.
Ignore the fact
there
there's
are,
no
there
demand and just build a world class stadium and get a test team along. I mean, it's an extraordinary model in that sense.
And so to the book review, and this week we have been hugely enjoying Duncan Hamilton's A Last English Summer. Hamilton he didn't make his name as a cricket writer. He came to real attention for his biography of Brian Clough, Provided You Don't Kiss Me. He grew up in Yorkshire, within spitting distance, he tells us in the book, of Bill Barrell's, the great fast bowler's house. And one of the things that really comes across for me in this book is just simply how well written it is.
I think let's just get this disclosure out of the way right at the start. Being the 26th episode, this is the 26th book we've reviewed, and I would make a very good claim for saying that in its own way it might just be the best. It's superbly written. And
top five, sir.
Oh, top five. Let's just say top one. The standard of writing is superb, and we'll do more on that as we go, but let's just start with the format, because the format makes it fairly unique. he talks about and he openly acknowledges a debt to J.B. Priestley and the English Journey, obviously written in the 30s, kind of a state of the nation book about England, and to Geoffrey Moorhouse, whose book, what the hell is that book called? The Last Summer, I think. That
The Best Loved Game.
The Best Loved Game, that we've also reviewed.
Yeah.
And he acknowledges debt to those both those books and then goes on to do something that is truly his own.
It's
part history, part sort of individual biopic, sort of part match reports, but part also sort of a state of the game piece as well.
What he does so well is effectively he's travelling around the country and every chapter takes as its centre a game, whether that's an Ashes test, whether it's a game, a county game, or whether it's just a village game. And so you get the story of the game and you get a match report, a scorecard at the end of it. But what he does is so much more than just a description of the game per se.
I think if you talk about it as a technique, the game is kind of the centre of it. The game is sort of the central kind of conceit at the middle of it. But he branches out, and the branches out is where it gets kind of exciting. He's very precise in his match reports in that he chooses what is exciting. He doesn't bother to necessarily give a blow-by-blow account. In some cases, he dismisses large parts of the game.
Which is very different to Geoffrey Moorhouse, who felt a duty to record the game as it was happening.
Hence why I think this is superior.
Exactly, and what Hamilton does exactly, as you say, is he uses these individual games as a starting point to then go and talk about all kinds of other things mostly historical.
Right, but every single game, I think I'm right in saying, he uses as a premise for historical sort of investigation. So, for example, when he talks about the county championship game between Nottinghamshire and Somerset, it's a great opportunity for him to talk about Neville Carders. When it's the Australians coming to Worcestershire, a great opportunity to talk about Bradman. And even if you looked at them as standalone pieces of writing, they are fascinating insights into cricket history. What he does sort of much more, though, on top of that, is use each game as a kind of opportunity to look at, well, where cricket is right now. So there's very much that sort of state of the nation side of it. And also, within each game, he seems to often pick up on a particular individual of interest and really give a sort of personality insight. So I think, before we sort of go any further, it's worth recognising that this is a format that is complex, and I think in the hands of a lesser writer would fail dismally. Mm.
I think one of the things, what something you've just touched on, which I really enjoyed in the book, was his ability to bring through personality. There's a fantastic chapter on the Nat West or Benson or whatever, wasn't Benson, whoever the sponsor was, 40 over fun at Lords in 2009, and he follows through Dominic Cork throughout the whole thing, coming to the end of his career, and the way that he brings through, the way that he sees the game through personality, and he doesn't see the game as an abstract scorecard to be elucidated, he sees it as something much more personal than that. There's also a fantastic description of Ricky Ponting after the Ashes have been lost in 2009 and hit in the one dayers, and there's a couple of pages where he describes Ponting standing outside before a game and just sort of talks about the feelings that Ponting must be going through as a human being.
I think what it's so easy for some of these personalities to become almost cliched. We've seen them written about so often. I mean, my personal favourite moment is when he talks about going to watch Andrew Flintoff at a county championship game where he was in desperate need of proving his form. And Flintoff, perhaps of any England cricketer of the last decade, has been written about constantly. And somehow, Hamilton makes him seem new. And somehow, like any good biographer does, gets to the essence of a person. And there's these wonderful lines, like I know it always seems wrong to maybe just, you know, use this section to read sections of the book out, but it is so much
when
fun.
The book's so good.
When the book's so much good, the more I look at him, the more I think he fulfills Twain's description of someone who is no more or less than himself. The figures, frankly, don't illuminate Flintoff as statistically great, but there was something otherworldly about him here nonetheless. The feeling persists that if only briefly, he'll accomplish the unexpected. And that says more than I'm sure many biographies of Flintoff will ever say as a character. So it's incredible. It's incredible skill he has to get to the essence of some of cricket's key personalities.
He does, and I think the other way that he is able to get to the essence of cricket and the essence of personality, and actually the poetry of the whole thing, is simply the way that his writing is so spectacular.
His writing is extraordinary, and we were talking about this before coming on air. He uses a lot of metaphors, a huge number of metaphors and similes in his match reports. I often find this quite contrived in sports journalism. I often find it quite like the writer, in an attempt to avoid a cliche, has used a metaphor and has used a simile. With Hamilton, it is always precisely applied. Every metaphor or simile has been thought through. A couple of wonderful examples. Mike Hussey batting in this game against Worcestershire is described as promptly getting his head over every ball like an old-fashioned accountant studiously bent across a ledger. It's beautiful. Mm. I mean, as an image, it's perfect.
And it actually adds something, because you're right, that very often you get... one of the first books we reviewed was Gary Sobers' King Cricket, which is just a dreadful, dreadful book for almost every reason. But what he does is he sort of... What Sobers does is to use metaphors, and actually it's kind of a trademark of all bad writers, is to use metaphors kind of to cover up the fact that you haven't really got anything to say. Whereas what Hamilton does is he really, really elucidates things. And he actually... What he's not afraid of is to be... ambiguous. To do the kind of word painting that doesn't give you a direct impression of something. I mean, it's a similar thing about him not going... When he describes a game, he doesn't do it ball by ball. He does it in terms of the general impression of the... Which is why he can afford to say, I'm going to see this game, but through the character of Dominic Cork, or through the character of Ricky Ponting, which gives a much richer view
of the... It's interesting, because during a section where he really slates IPL cricket commentary, he actually provides a rather useful guide to what I think is the principle that he applies to his own writing. He says, language becomes a dud currency when it is used for effect rather than purpose. Mm. And I think that's your point when you talk about sort of ambiguity. He always has a sense of what he is trying to create, and then maybe that leaves... He still leaves stuff for the readers to work out. But it's never used tokenly. These metaphors and similes are never used tokenly or pointlessly. I mean, I think we talked sort of a lot about the unique and fascinating structure of the book, how well written it is. I mean, there's a couple of things to say on kind of what his view of cricket... I mean, as an aside, I think it's really interesting to see a writer who knows the game so well have... a very balanced view on 2020. You get at some stage, you start reading the book and you think this book is going to be a nostalgia fest. Everything that was old was a golden age. Everything new is depressing and sad. But he has a very balanced view on 2020. He talks about how he dislikes the forced jollity of it. He talks about how he dislikes the kind of gimmicks of it. And he's very precise.
The kind of clothing, yeah.
So, yeah, and he's very precise. But he's also willing to accept that he actually says, well... He has a wonderful line where he talks about it's churlish to ask whether this is real cricket or not because of the high entertainment level. He's willing to accept that whether this is real cricket or not, this is something that has a value that could be said. But he does still have a respect for history, doesn't he? That comes across very much in his writing.
He does, and actually one of the things that enables him to have that kind of magnanimity almost towards 2020 is the fact that he talked very explicitly elsewhere about the fact that in the 1980s, people, well, even, you know, before that, in the 1960s, when one-day cricket started really appearing in England, the fact that everyone saw it as such a newfangled thing that would never possibly catch on. And this is one of the wonderful things about the structure of the book and the way that he is able to use history as context to elucidate the present. And it really does tie everything together really well in a way that provides a more rounded picture of the present than anything else, I think.
I think what I realised reading the book is how cricket fans, maybe more than fans of other sports, get their context so strongly from history in every game. Every game is put in the context of what's come before, and every single game, every person playing the game relates to people who played years and years before. And in some ways that sounds like a really obvious point. You know, we know as cricket fans that we take an interest in the history of the game. But what the book kind of reminds me of, that actually that is something that cricket fans really prize and really, really value. And I think there's an interesting, very personal side to that as well in the book, because he talks about how his relationship with cricket was very tied into his relationship with his grandfather. And how it's not just cricket's history, but his own personal history that's become very much entangled with the game.
One very quick last point, which is that actually how the format makes it very, very easy reading. Dividing everything up into chapters that are, in a sense, sequential, but that every single little one is a sort of bite-sized chunk that's actually a rather nice thing.
I challenge anyone to pick this book up and not finish it in a moment. It's compelling stuff.
And if that's not a recommendation, I don't know what is.
To the debate, and And this week, in the aftermath of the Abu Dhabi test, where there were plenty of empty seats, we're going to debate, is cricket without a crowd a game without a purpose?
I'd argue that it's not. And I don't by any means suggest that cricket should always be played in front of empty stadia. And I certainly,
that would be a radical proposition.
I certainly don't deny that having that it's better to have a great atmosphere and to have a full stadium. But I would object to the idea that one shouldn't play cricket in the UAE because no one at the moment is watching it. The main reason I think this is because trailblazing is rarely a populist thing, and that the game isn't going to be able to break into new markets if no one's willing to take the game to new markets. It's exactly what we were talking about earlier, that unless there's a kind of groundswell from the popular, you know, bottom up, it's going to be very, very difficult to take the game anywhere. At the same time, I think there's a very good argument for playing cricket for cricket's sake. And yes, I'm going to be accused, probably rightly, of being an old fart for saying this, but I think the game has a lot of problems from the fact that since professionalism, well, not necessarily since professionalism, but certainly over the last 10 years, the way that marketing has come into it in such a huge way, and the way that money's come into it in such a huge way, and that actually the be-all and end-all of cricket is somehow appealing to a mass market. Gideon Hay put it very nicely when talking about 2020 cricket, when he said that when 2020 cricket was created, it was created in order to make the game of cricket appealing to people who don't like cricket. And I'm not saying for a moment that therefore one should only play the most dour sorts of test matches with 11 Geoffrey Boycotts or Chris Tavares on the pitch. But I do think there's something to be said for sometimes not pandering to the public opinion and not thinking that having a full stadium is the be-all and end-all of cricket.
I think it's very difficult. I think there is, obviously, there's been a sense that 2020 is part of a rise of populism within, like, the ICC, like, play to the crowds. But I think it's also worth thinking that to say that we should play real cricket and kind of ignore the interest of the fans is a kind of incredibly arrogant sort of statement. It's forgetting the fact that ultimately the fans are, without wanting to use, well, I'm about to use a real marketing term here, they're the key stakeholders. You know, they are what makes cricket in many ways valuable. Put your hand down, Mr. Chan.
No, am I allowed to jump in here?
Give me 30 seconds.
I'll give you 30 seconds.
I think nothing is more miserable than an empty stadium. I think we've seen that recently. I think for me, the saddest case of that recently was in a brilliant, brilliant West Indies-India test at Eden Gardens. A fantastic, wonderful venue that was totally devoid of atmosphere. And it's important to realise that cricket as a game is connected to that atmosphere. It's connected with that buzz. And it becomes less valuable when it doesn't have it. I think the game has a duty, coming back to this idea of stakeholders, to remember and value its spectators. And I think it's possible to take those interests into account without demeaning the game. I don't necessarily think, perhaps it's something that 2020 has gone wrong on, I don't think it's necessarily a question of compromising cricket to get people in. You have the floor.
Well, I don't. Your argument that crowds are the stakeholders and therefore that one should take into account what they want is a hugely destructive one, I think, actually. I've got to lay my cards on the table here for our listeners that I work in marketing and it's something that I think about quite a lot.
Okay, yeah.
The idea that you're supposed to know that, I think. But the idea that actually you should tailor your product to, you can tailor the packaging of your product to an audience, but if you tailor your product to an audience, basically what you'd end up doing if you wanted to get the vast majority of people as your audience, you'd end up just setting up a porn channel or something like that. I might be sounding ridiculously polemic, but that is actually the logical extension of saying that you have to basically give people what they want. Because, and I think basically there needs to be more belief within the game that what we have in Test cricket is something that is very special.
Well,
and if we believe in that, that we can then bring people round to seeing that. And I'm not saying, therefore, we should stand and say, and be completely implacable and say, we're right, you're wrong, you can only ever see things wrong. But I think one has to have belief in what one is putting out into the world as one's product.
Right, but I think, so Test cricket is where this issue is most pertinent, I think. It's this idea that Test cricket is seen by true cricket aficionados, I mean, I've almost made that judgment there, but it's seen by a lot of the best players and a lot of committed fans as real cricket. It's where the game's most exciting, it's where the game is most, it's tested to the full, it's where its complexities are most obvious. And yet, it's the part of the game that has the biggest problem with getting consistent crowds in. And what I need to say is that it is possible to maintain the integrity of the game while still accept the fact that there is a reason why, there are multiple reasons why crowds aren't coming. And actually, unless we take that into account, and unless we realise that actually, it's when we talk about being a game without a purpose, I don't think there is a purpose in playing excellent game of Test cricket to endless empty stadiums.
I agree absolutely, and that wasn't my argument at all. My argument was that in the short term, that my argument is effectively that this series in the United Arab Emirates is not pointless. It is played to basically empty stadiums, but it is going somewhere. If it's not going anywhere, I agree. If cricket was played, actually, well, no, I don't actually agree entirely, because I play Saturday cricket for a club, and no one comes and watches.
I agree, and I absolutely love it, and it's not
struggling. It's hugely successful, and it's a really, and everyone who goes, there are 22
enjoys
people,
it very much.
24
yeah.
people who love it, and there is no crowd whatsoever. So the game is absolutely purposeful. But I realise that the main point we're having is with Test cricket. But I think it's very interesting to think that can you imagine what? So you go to county grounds playing 4-day cricket, and it's actually, you know, there may only be, you know, 1,000 people there max, a few hundred people there, but the game carries on and can survive that. But can you imagine having a 2020 IPL game with no one there? Now that would feel ridiculous.
Now that's an interesting distinction. I mean, county championship is the next area where, aside from Test cricket, this sort of dichotomy exists between this idea of real cricket and no one watching.
Yep.
And I'm in this strange camp where I often love going to county cricket games where no one watches. I think it's great, you know, you have a whole sort of stand to yourself. But at the same time, I think the game risks being accused of sort of arrogance if it doesn't recognise that we need to make an effort to see why that's the case and to recognise that even if I concede to you the point that actually it's not entirely without purpose, that a great county championship game played to an audience of 10 men and 2.5 dogs still has a purpose, but that it is considerably less of a thing than a game played to a greater crowd, and that cricket needs to take into account, and I mean, in the sense that yes, 2020 is a populist thing, but so much of how cricket is run now entirely disregards the interests of the fans. I mean, the 7-match one-day international series,
yeah,
I would always hold up as the advantage.
Yeah,
that.
It does. And I agree absolutely that it is that one should be trying to. I mean, as cricket lovers, we believe that more people should be coming to watch cricket.
Sure.
But there is a danger of throwing the baby out with the bathwater and saying that crowds are the be-all and end-all. And actually, I think it's a balance between saying what we have as the game in and of itself inherently is a very, very special thing. It's a balance between that and wanting to get it out to the maximum number of people. And so what sometimes I object to slightly with, say, 2020, is the fact that it seems to be creating a completely new game in order to please an audience who don't like cricket, basically. That's massively paraphrasing
Gideon Hayes'
argument. I think there's a balance to be struck between the two. You don't want to be playing to empty stadia, and you also don't want to be changing the game completely in order to pander to people.
Well, I think that was fun. thank you very much for listening to the 26th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. Next time we'll have more from Australia, more from the United Arab Emirates. We may even finally have our long-promised bright spanking new website, so stick with us for that.